being some sort of a dark force, you know.
Opposite to God.
Opposite to God.
There's no, it's not like that.
There's no opposite to God.
No, there isn't. There's just God.
There's just God.
Yes.
And everything happens within his plan. And part of his plan is to have an entity like the Satan. Sin. And we even have Shayateen talking about different
Satans.
Yes,
that's right. Different Satans, yes.
You know, we have Iblis, yes. Which is, you know.
Yes. We also have our internal Satans as
right.
well.
Right. So this the ayah that I was talking about is actually referring to Iblis.
Very good.
Which is, you know, the... Yes, the main shaitan.
The main shaitan, the arch shaitan, yes. Right? As the U.S. is today.
Right.
Yes.
So this is the point yeah. that, you know, it's basically... And it's interesting. I think this is a very interesting subject to actually think about. Mm. You have, again, in the Quran, yes. shaitan talking about how... And the Quran describes it, how on the Day of Judgment, shaitan will renounce all the people that he led astray. And
exactly.
he will say, all I did was obey my Lord.
Exactly.
So, you know.
That's right. Because he had his permission to do that in the first place. And then he says, well,
I'm not. You're not from me. I praise the Lord.
Yeah, that's right. And he said, well, they did that of their own free will. I mean, I had no power over them. I couldn't control them.
So, you know, Shaitan is a very interesting...
He is a very interesting character.
Right.
And not somebody I'd like to associate that
right.
And
I'm simply
and
saying interesting yes. in the sense that, mm. you know, it's interesting to look at his place within this divine...
Plan.
Within this divine structure.
Yes.
So, given all that, this was all an introduction in terms of why would Imam
Khomeini, God bless his soul, use this term. Yes,
right.
exactly.
It wasn't, as you correctly pointed out, simply a rhetorical flourish or some sort of emotional...
response to something.
Right. Yeah. It was a very clear statement of the nature and the essence of who we're dealing with.
Dealing with, yes.
Okay. And I would add something to that, which is that... A big part, or maybe the... And it's very interesting that we recently had this discussion again in the media. Americans, because of their Protestant background, because of their whole biblical way of looking at things, I'm talking about initially when America was...
That's true, yes.
Was started.
You're quite right,
and
sir.
This coming out of Britain and coming out of the different dissident movements within the Protestant movements in England...
That's correct, yes.
They have this belief that they are chosen people.
They do. You know, it's pretty much interesting how that's
right.
in line
and
with Israel.
This is something that's been discussed by academics, so this is not... I'm not saying anything new here.
No, you're not.
There's a whole set of literature on this matter that Protestants consider themselves to be the chosen people. That, you know, you had the Israelites and the Bani Israel initially, then you had, you know, the church, and then after the church, I'm talking about the Catholic Church.
That's right, yes. That's
and
right.
once the Catholic Church went astray, then it was...
The Protestants.
Know, the burden fell onto the Protestants.
Yes, that's correct, yes.
To take on God's, you know...
I mean, this is very interesting because I've heard this a lot, even in the UK, you know, that they do describe the US as being an apocalyptic nation in the sense that they're coming out of something right out of the Bible.
Well, what I was going to add is that once that aspect of things, in the 20th century where you have this kind of secularization happening, it becomes something else. It's called, they don't say we're chosen people anymore. They say we're the exceptional nation.
The exceptional nation.
Exceptionalism.
Yes,
this is exactly what Putin and Obama were arguing about. I don't know if you remember, Putin wrote the article.
Putin wasn't very happy about that
conversation. And he said, you know, we don't have exceptional nations.
No.
We all, you know, ask for forgiveness from the Lord. Okay?
Yes. And we all have to make do on this planet.
Right.
Yes.
And so basically, and this is a big debate within the U.S., one of the things that the Republicans and the conservatives criticized Obama for during the first round that he was running was when they asked Obama, is America an exceptional nation? He really didn't give a very, you know, patriotic answer to that. He said, well, we're exceptional just as other nations are exceptional in their own way. Mm. Gingrich had a whole book about it, how, you know, this shows that Obama is not really understanding what American civilization is and we are the exceptional nation.
Sure.
All that. We come, this is, you know, in this first term, we get to the point in Syria where he basically, the only thing he could say about why they want to bomb Syria is, and this was in the press conference, the initial press conference that he announced that he was going to do this. He said, well, in the end, we're going to do this because we're America.
Yes, that's right. Yes.
You remember?
Yes, I remember.
We're America, and America has to do this.
America has to do this.
Right. We are the only ones that can do this. We're the ones that have this responsibility.
Yeah.
Because we're an exceptional nation.
Ah.
We're different than the others.
Mm.
Okay?
Sure.
Now, when did Imam talk about this stuff?
Oh, my goodness. We are way back.
78?
Yes.
Yes.
I think so. 78, 79, yes.
Right. So, alhamdulillah, thank God, we see the world is coming to where,
yes.
Imam was
years ago.
When he says that it is the great Satan, it's more than saying you are not exceptional. It is saying that by you
very good point,
claiming
yes.
to be the exceptional nation, claiming to
excellent.
Be the chosen people, mm. you are arrogating something for yourself.
Self, which you do not deserve.
And which is dangerous, which
dangerous,
leads people
yes.
astray, which leads people into the fire, which leads to their destruction, which leads to your own destruction.
Your own self-destruction as well.
And
that's
as
right.
such, we have to stand up against you.
Exactly.
We cannot be indifferent to you.
No.
Okay? This is all, you know, and I think it's good that we're talking about these things at this moment because mm. there's all this talk again about, you know, let's have a deal with the Americans. I'm talking about in terms of, you know,
Diplomacy and other things. Yeah, that's right. Yes.
And, you know, fine. Everybody does
okay.
their diplomacy.
Sure.
You know, nobody's
true.
Against diplomacy.
No.
You go, you talk, you
yes.
make your point.
And you agree to disagree.
And this is the beautiful thing that, you know, the leader always talks about, Supreme Leader always talks about, is that, you know the essence and the real identity of your enemy. This is, again, he's been talking about this in a number of speeches recently.
Point.
Where he says it's fine. He even used the term heroic flexibility, which was a very interesting way of saying it. He said, look, you know, we talk to everyone. He used the example of a wrestler, because, you know, Iranians were wrestlers.
You have a great tradition.
We beat everyone recently.
We
had the world championships.
You have. Yes.
We beat everyone again, as usual.
As usual, yes.
We even had that meet in New York in Grand Central Station where they were invited, and we beat all the Americans in the
excellent.
Wrestling. Okay, just for the record.
Just for the record.
Just
yes.
for the record. Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you for me.
So when the Supreme Leader uses wrestling analogies, this is something that is very, you know,
appropriate
in Iran. Everybody understands what he's talking about. And he was talking about that when a wrestler, you know, is in a clinch and is wrestling with his opponent, he might, you know, show some flexibility at times. He might let go of some area at some point. But he never forgets what he's doing.
Doing, yes.
He never forgets what the enemy is after.
After, yes.
So this is the point. I think when Imam, you know, so brilliantly and so powerfully
used
the word
expression,
great
yes.
Satan,
yes.
he completely changed the framework
mm.
in which people were looking at the United States.
Exactly.
He completely, you know, this is the great ability, this is the ability of great, you know, leaders.
Yes.
Is they don't simply enter a debate. They actually shape the debate.
They shape it.
Okay?
That's
they
right.
they determine the
framework parameters in
of
which
the debate.
Of that debate, yes.
His thing was not, well, you know, the Americans have been unjust to us for 50 years and they overthrew.
No,
he said
no.
they are the great Satan.
This is
our starting
he
point.
He hit the nail on the head. That's our
starting
point.
Is you are the
great
Satan.
Yeah.
Okay?
Yeah.
And this is, we deal with you as the great
Satan.
Whatever we have to do, we do.
Mm.
And it's interesting because, you know, even Imam then in his final testament writes about the fact that, and this is, I think, one of those, I mean, it's just, you know, sometimes he says things and you think, okay, you know, where did this guy, like, where did he come from?
Exactly.
You know, I mean, he was just amazing, some of the things he would say.
No, he was beyond time in that sense.
He said
know?
In mm. his final testament, he mm. said, you know, maybe there will come a time
mm,
when we can be, when we can have relations with the United States if they change their attitude towards us. If they change their
that's right,
arrogance
yes, yes.
and they change their...
That's
their
right. He did say that.
So this is something that he's leaving the door. He's basically saying, yes, you are the great Satan,
but
it's because of your own behavior.
Yeah.
You can have an... And it's interesting, in that same sentence he says, but we will never be friends with Ali Saud. This is very interesting. This was after they killed the
pilgrims in
the
80
pilgrims.
In 1987. That's right. When they slaughtered the Hajj pilgrim pilgrims in that year.
Right.
That's right.
So you know this is very to me
interesting.
This is interesting
very
because
interesting.
What you have is a is Imam basically saying this is the essence and this is the identity and this is the you know the characteristic
of the U.S.
of the U.S.
But you can you may be able to have some relations.
Listen,
with
this is the point about really understanding that you know it's all from Allah. Right?
It is.
It's
very
not
much
something
so.
That you, you know.
No, you can do from yourself. No.
Right.
No.
So we have him, you know, talking about the great Satan.
Yes.
Again, going back to the way we understand Shaitan in the Islamic sources,
right.
And then of course looking at America's behavior globally.
Sure.
And isn't it interesting that these 34 years have just confirmed everything that
that's right. It's exposed
I mean,
America for what it
isn't. Isn't really America the most hated
It is?
You know, in the nation in the world right now by other people.
Well, it's a gangster, isn't it?
Really? Isn't it something
it's a, like a large Al Capone,
and remember,
you know,
what
at
time
the
Imam did this. Imam did this at a time when the U.S. was, you know, the great superpower.
Yes.
Standing up to the evil Soviets,
that's right.
to the and godless communists.
That's right.
Right? So, you know, America had a certain...
image.
Right. They even...
defenders of the free world.
They even, you know, had done what they did in Europe in World War II and standing up to the Nazis and standing up to, you know,
sure.
the different forces that existed, which were all considered to be very good things by everybody. And and they are good things.
Yes.
Of course it's good to stand up to, you know, a crazy person like Hitler.
Yes.
Okay? It's, of course it's good to stand up to Stalinism. So
yes.
these are things that, you know, America had on its, you know,
plus
resume.
Had on its CV. Yeah.
With all the negative stuff as well, like,
sure.
you know, all the coup d'etats and the killings and the murders
yeah.
in Latin America and around the world.
Yeah,
after
the ones that they wouldn't speak about necessarily.
Right,
yes.
So before World War II, all the stuff that they did in the world, they already were practicing in Latin America. So
sure.
since the Monroe Doctrine, you know, started. So this was, so it's not, we're not trying to say that it was all good or all bad, but
yeah.
there were elements.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Now, we see, you know, the first time the U.S. is seriously challenged in the Cold War.
Sure.
By a so-called third world nation, by a developing nation, is the Islamic Revolution. And, you know, isn't it beautiful that at that time, you know, it was, you know, we're neither West nor East, we're Islamic Republic.
Republic, yes.
So it wasn't like every other situation in the Cold War where if you were going to go against the U.S., you would necessarily
join
be with
the Soviet
bloc.
Yes, that's
okay?
right.
Or if you were with the Soviet Union, you were necessarily against the U.S. This is the kind of world that the Americans and the Soviets wanted.
Exactly.
And they had created to
but
a certain
Iran
extent.
Broke out of that
Iran
because
broke
of Islam.
Out of that complete mold. And that's why you see that...
thanks to Imam Khomeini, God
that's why you
soul.
See the Americans and the Soviets supporting Saddam during
exactly,
the war.
Exactly.
Okay? They're giving him weapons.
Yeah.
And all of everybody's supporting Saddam.
They had to contain this because
right?
this
so
was
like
a very dangerous idea.
Right. I mean, this was like... you know, the
this
Soviets
was toxic.
And Soviets and the Americans, hey, we need to be on this, we are together on this one.
Right.
Which is, you know, just think about that for
a
second.
It was extraordinary.
And so basically what you had, and it's funny because at that time they said, well, the Soviets are the little Satan. Okay?
Yes, that's right, they're the little Satan. Yes.
We forgot about that.
Yeah, we forgot about that.
Because the Soviets don't exist anymore, so
yes,
you know, it doesn't
right.
matter.
So. Yeah, so that's why he was little, because he was going to resign pretty
so
soon.
So this is, there's also a point in that, which is that the main enemy...
is going to be the U.S.
Right. So it is in this environment that, you know, our dear Imam said these things.
Sure.
He framed the debate. He called out the U.S. and, you know, pointed out to the real identity of the U.S. and its behavior towards others.
Sure.
Again, I repeat, when Imam talks about the great Satan, he's talking about something that's also partly in the control of the U.S. of how it behaves.
Sure.
This is not some sort of a, you know, preordained, you know.
No, it's not, no.
Where there's no influence.
Because that's very interesting that you're saying that.
Because that's not part of Islam.
Yeah, because
everyone is capable of redemption.
Or changing their behavior,
right.
That's right. So he says that if they can change their conduct, there may be some room for negotiation.
Right.
Yeah.
So the point is, again, the beautiful thing that he did is that from an Islamic perspective, he clearly drew the line.
Yes, he did.
Because we see, brother, look at how miserably Ikhwan failed in Egypt.
Oh, for goodness sake.
Why?
Yeah,
because
exactly.
they didn't understand
I mean,
who America was.
Exactly.
Okay?
Yeah.
So this is important Islamically.
That's right.
Okay? I'm talking now Islamically.
Yes,
we'll go
because
step by step.
They made a fundamental mistake in their revolution.
What we saw, unfortunately, in these last years is that the Ikhwan, you know, didn't understand the nature of America.
No.
They thought that, well, we got the population to vote for us, so we'll play everyone.
Yes.
We'll deal with the Americans. We'll keep our ambassador in Israel. We'll try to, you know, be friendly with the Americans.
Yeah, try to be everything,
you know,
to all things.
Right.
And it all went pear-shaped.
Exactly. Why? Because from the beginning, they were not able to distinguish the reality and the identity and the essence of
who
the other side is.
Yes.
What the enemy is.
Exactly.
Something which was very important and completely different when it came to the Islamic Revolution in Iran because of the leadership of somebody like Imam.
Yes.
And it's always Imam standing there when everybody is confused.
Yes.
And everybody's
not so sure about what to do.
What were we supposed to do? Imam saying, this is it.
This
and
is
he was always right.
He was always right.
And this is a miracle.
This is extraordinary. Really, this is.
I mean, you know, I'm not trying to.
No.
He's not Masoom. He's a normal human being.
You've said that in a previous program, which was a very appropriate thing that you said at the time, and a very excellent point. where you said that no, this comes naturally out of the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt.
Exactly.
This is something expected of us.
And
if,
again,
if we follow
repeat,
it properly, that's the conclusion we'd come to.
I repeat that beautiful sentence or that phrase by Shahid Sadr.
Yes, please.
You know, Ayatollah Muhammad Baghir Sadr,
yes,
who was martyred by, you know,
Saddam, yes,
crazy Saddam,
yes,
where that he tells his students, he tells his students, he says, you know, rubu, which is, you know, how would you melt into Imam,
yes.
Become, you know, become one with Imam.
Imam.
The way Imam has melted into has become one with Islam.
My God.
Okay?
What
so
a beautiful expression.
Right. So he's beautiful Imam expression. Is completely, you know, manifestation of all those teachings.
Masha.
Both in terms of the knowledge and in terms of acting on it.
Acting on it.
He's a manifestation of that.
He was the manifestation.
You know,
of
it's
that.
Interesting because we always use the word Ayatollah. He really is Ayatollah.
He was really Ayatollah. He was.
Because he was a sign of God.
There were books I remember that came out in the UK, you know, and it simply said the sign of God. Right. And there was a big portrait of Imam Khomeini. There you are.
Right. So he really was Ayatollah.
Because
we use Ayatollah in terms of a title.
Yes. But then he was really the Ayatollah.
But then we really have Ayatollah. And of course, all of us are Ayatollah in a certain way.
We are, but
the whole of creation is Ayatollah.
Yeah, but we're
but you know, he was
yeah.
And you know, this is good for us to have experience because you know we're distant from the time of the Prophet.
Yes.
You know, when you're in the presence of a Prophet or the Imams, yes. It's clear.
It's very, very clear.
I mean, it wasn't clear to everyone, but
no. Of course, you know? I know. There were certain exceptions in
right.
those cases.
We don't want to get to that.
We don't want to get to
but
that.
But the point is that, you know, that presence already itself is maybe the biggest proof for a lot of people.
It is.
Just the presence of somebody
the presence,
like,
yes.
of the Prophet, peace be upon him.
Yes.
Or people like Imam Ali alayhi salam or the other Imams that were there. So and you know, we're removed from that era. And yet we see somebody, at least for me, this was the case, I'm sure it was for you.
Yes, it
those
was.
Of us
it
who,
certainly
who,
was, sir.
Who experienced
yes.
Imam.
Thank God.
You know, thank yes. God we yeah. lived to see him.
See that, yes. Because really we were very, very distant from any understanding of religion or God or even our purpose in life. And to be honest, you know, this man, you know, I mean, we don't want to use words like miracle and things like, because that's not what we're saying. We're really saying that, no, because he was living on the true teachings of Islam, he made us see what Islam
right.
is.
Right, and it was beyond, it was immediate, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It was existential, it was immediate.
It was immediate, yes.
It wasn't something that...
It spoke to your soul.
It wasn't indirect, it was direct.
It was direct.
It wasn't something that was mediated, when I'm using the word immediate.
No,
I mean,
no.
It
no,
wasn't mediated.
No, no. Certainly in Glasgow, you can't get that. It really touched your soul.
Right.
It did.
It wasn't something, you know, planned or sometimes, you know, staged.
Yes.
It was genuine.
It was genuine.
It was real. You could really feel that this is coming from, you know, the source.
The source, yes. the real source.
Right.
The original source.
When he would say the words, you knew that this is what was in his heart. It wasn't, you know, some sort of artistic or...
No, I mean, the thing is, the media at the time, and you know, the UK media is one of the most vicious, one of the most,
right.
I
the
don't
most
know,
vicious.
Nefarious type
right.
of media there is. But even they hung on every word that the Ayatollah had to say.
Right.
It was like, you know, what is he going to say the next day? They were even having, trying to anticipate that,
right.
you know, exactly what he was going to say.
And remember, we quoted from the book that we're using.
Yes.
We talked about, you know, the big crime or the big sin of Imam was that, and as the Telegraph, I think it was the Telegraph, or
Telegraph
the Times,
that
sorry,
it
was the Times.
The Times
talking
the
about,
Times,
you know,
right.
he actually dared to tell people that they can stand up to the Americans and
that's
they
right.
can, you know, they have power.
they have know? Power, yeah, the
right?
people have power. Yes.
So imagine, this is a society in which, you know, you have mass illiteracy, you have basically a feudal system,
sure.
you have people who have very little feeling of empowerment,
sure.
and here comes a man and he completely empowers them. And the great world power, again, I'm using the word power on purpose.
Yes.
So you have, you know, a taking away of the power of America and that image and calling it the great city and giving power to people who otherwise would be considered, you know, the lowest of the
Well, low. I mean, I think on that note, we can end this program by saying that Imam Khomeini, may God bless his great soul, never said anything without wisdom.
Exactly.
Number one. And number two, because of the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt. And number two, this empowerment of the people. I mean, this was something the Imam deeply held in his heart,
right.
that he believed that civil disobedience, peaceful civil disobedience
exactly.
was the way to bring down imperial powers.
And it
that,
did.
And it's, that formula works today.
And it did.
It did.
And what you do first is you actually point out the reality of who you're dealing with.
Exactly.
And this is what
yeah,
he did.
Yes, and
this
point
is what
out the
did.
True nature of your exactly. enemy. Thank you very much. And on that note, it just leaves me to thank our listeners for listening to our program today. And it leaves me to say, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. May the peace and mercy and blessings of Allah be upon you all. Thank you for listening, and goodbye.
Chef Jaffa, González Bornet. Spain fell under the control of the Roman Empire in 206 BCE when it was named Hispania. Christianity remained the official religion of the country for a long time, but it gradually lost its position there over time, while no other religion replaced it. Located in the southwest of Europe, Spain shares borders with Portugal and France and is home to the world's two famous football clubs, Real Madrid and Barcelona. Raúl González, a favorite Spanish name and also the name of a former Real Madrid striker, Raúl González is also the name of a man we want to tell the story of. His full name is Raúl González Bornet. He is not a celebrity, but has a strange story. He has chosen Shia Islam as his religion after doing a lot of study and research. His valuable essays about the sixth Shia Imam are regarded as a turning point in his life and have been greatly welcomed, mainly by the followers of the Prophet Muhammad and his household. The essays are so popular that they have made some people call him Sheikh Ja'far Raúl González. Sheikh Ja'far was born in the Spanish capital, Madrid, in 1950 and grew up in a communist family. In 1968, he began a three-year course on electronic engineering. He was later arrested over his anti-fascist activities, and following that, he took refuge in a mountainous area near Madrid. There, he lived in a mean cottage, a place he chose to deal with his personal concerns and search for the truth. He studied religions. Sheikh Ja'far was attracted to Shia Islam after he read a book entitled The Brother of Prophet, written by U.S.-based Lebanese researcher and scholar Javad Shiri. Sheikh Ja'far then traveled to Iran, where he began to study at the Al-Mustafa International University in the holy city of Qom. He got a PhD in Quranic studies from that academic and seminary institute. Sheikh Ja'far is now doing research on religions and translates Islamic texts. Sheikh Ja'far's return from Iran coincided with the 9/11 attacks that resulted in organized Islamophobic moves by European media, including those in Spain. Such moves began at a time when the situation of Muslims in Europe was not satisfactory, something ongoing before the 9/11 attacks. That prompted Sheikh Jaffer and some of his Shia friends, who were mostly from Iraq and Lebanon, to begin working against the anti-Muslim campaign in Spain. To that end, they formed an NGO called Muslims Seek Peace. With the media in Spain and other European countries providing extensive coverage of events, it may seem difficult to raise the public attention on certain issues only through an NGO that has limited capabilities compared with those powerful and well-equipped media outlets. However, Sheikh Jaffer and his friends made that possible by their relentless efforts and accomplished what they sought. As part of their efforts to change the public opinion about Muslims, they held ceremonies to mark religious events such as celebrations for Islamic festivities. Other measures included articles that were printed and distributed during some of these ceremonies. The articles covered various issues, including ideological ones, and most of the time led to question-answer meetings. In addition, films mostly featuring Israeli crimes against Palestinians were shown. Many have also been attracted to sessions about the Holy Quran and interpreting its verses. Hospitality is one of the characteristics of the Spanish people that distinguishes them from other Europeans. It is interesting to know that Spanish culture is a mixture of Christian, Islamic, and European African culture, and that is due to several hundreds of years of Muslim ruling over the country, a government known as Andalusia. This parking lot, located in the south of Madrid's palace, was formerly a key Muslim gravesite that, along with other Islamic structures, was destroyed after the fall of Muslims in Spain. The country is regarded as one of the main gateways of Islam's arrival in Western Europe. Maybe that is the reason behind European Union laws that indirectly back being tough with Muslims in order to prevent another power rise by them in Spain. Muslims ruled Spain for almost 781 years after they conquered Andalusia in 711 AD. During these years, Spain witnessed significant progress and was at the top compared with its neighbors in terms of civilization, culture, and urbanization. People in Spain greatly welcomed Islam. As a result, new buildings were gradually constructed around this palace and they were expanded further. Rulers holding small territories in Western Europe never managed to militarily defeat Muslims. But over time, with changes in the lifestyle of Muslims, their diligence was replaced with growing negligence and wantonness, and their years-long empire was defeated in 1492. After the fall of Muslims in 1492, Spain went through many crises to attain a high position among the world countries. Nonetheless, many experts believe that the country saw its prosperity during the Muslim rule and that it was not comparable with today's Spain. In order to prove that opinion is wrong and to reject it, different governments implemented political and economic theories presented by experts. But their attempts caused new problems, some of which still exist, and neoliberalism seems to be the latest effort to break an economic dead end. Mm-hmm. Spain has the highest unemployment rate in the European Union after Greece. That means one in every four people is jobless in Spain. The country is also facing a growing number of homeless people. Sheikh Jafar believes that faults currently existing in the economic system of Spain and even other European countries are covered up by a media propaganda campaign, and few people are aware of the real statistics. In most European countries, protests and crises led to the formation of political parties that expanded without gaining credibility and gradually lost people's trust. But in Spain, people under the slogan of We Can, which in Spanish means Podemos, formed a party that got a high position, which was even unexpected for the then politicians. Although politicians thought that people's support for the party was not deep and they would act traditionally in elections, it turned into the third strongest party in Spain's politics. Podemos, which is now one of the key political parties in Spain, is trying to have a strong and effective presence in mayoral elections. Therefore, the party has asked its headquarters in different parts of Spain to quickly introduce their representatives to the main office. Sheikh Jafar represents Muslims in a meeting by the party's regional branch in southern Madrid. The presence of Sheikh Jafar in such meetings is mainly aimed at doing research about political developments in Spain and the progress of the Podemos party. Therefore, his refusal to accept an offer by the Muslim members of the party to run as a candidate in the mayoral elections has two reasons. One is that he is too busy, and the second is that he does not know the party well. Development plans, austerity measures, and thousands of political and economic plans. But whether we like it or not, what Europe does not have today is spirituality. Leaders of big movements like Podemos have been born and raised in the West, and they have to obey Western systems. Even if their criticism of the ruling system is welcomed by the people and draws their attention for a limited period of time, at the end of the day, their ignorance of spiritual values results in what colonial politicians want. Such consequences gradually demotivate people and discourage them from taking any further action, and people, satisfied with their current lives, deal with their normal affairs. Less Muslims live in Spain than other European countries, something that has created different conditions there. That is the biggest problem Sheikh Jafar has been dealing with over the past years. The number of Muslims living in other European countries is big enough that any gathering by them is at least acceptable to them. But in Spain, not only the number of Muslims is very low, but also the mistrust of other communities has isolated them, and this makes it difficult for Sheikh Jafar to carry on his activities. Thank you. Communicating with young people living in different parts of Spain through social media is one of the important tasks that Sheikh Jafar performs. He tries to make the youth interested in Islam through writing Islamic texts, such as verses of the Holy Quran and words of the Prophet Muhammad's household. He also sends them Spanish-translated Islamic books, and by doing so, Sheikh Jafar plays a key role in expanding Islam. He is very hopeful that the youth find the true path, despite all the challenges and problems that exist.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
You're listening to the program The Key on IRIB English Radio with Shiraz Hossein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program, The Key, here at IRIB English Radio. I'm your host, Shiraz Agha. Thank you for joining us here today. Today we're going to be looking at the necessity of prophethood, the necessity of the divine revelation, and we want to address why is it that it is necessary for God to send divine revelations to human beings. If you remember, in some of our previous sessions, we examined this necessity from the point of view that human beings, in order for them to achieve felicity and happiness in this world and in the hereafter, they have to have a knowledge of their Creator. And we said that human beings, without the assistance of divine revelation, when they're left on their own, it's impossible for them to acquire this knowledge. Rather, they have to be assisted by God. God has to introduce himself to us through divine revelation. He has to tell us who he is, his attributes, what he is, what are his attributes, what kind of being he is, in order for us to acquire this knowledge. Left on our own, we cannot acquire this knowledge. And we said that a testament to this is all of the cases where human beings were misguided in their efforts to understand God. Maybe many human beings made a sincere effort to learn about their Creator, but how many of them were misguided from the truth? Some of them came to believe in polytheism, some of them came to believe in pantheism, and some of them came to believe in other incorrect notions about God. This shows us that left on their own, human beings cannot acquire this knowledge, which is necessary for their felicity. We said that an objection might be raised here, and that objection is this, that we see that in history, a lot of people did arrive at a proper understanding of God and their Creator without the assistance of divine revelation. A primary example of this is the sages, the Greek sages, the divine philosophers, right, who came to believe in God and believe came to believe in a lot of the in many of the ideas that the prophets spoke about without their assistance. So there's no need for prophethood. Human beings, when left on their own, they can arrive at this at these conclusions by themselves. One way that we can answer this objection is this, that we can say that it's true that these sages, they were monotheists. They believed in God. They were monotheists. And this is something that is true. I mean, divine revelation affirms this. But a lot of the things that they believed in were contrary to what? Contrary to the truth and contrary to what a divine revelation speaks about. A testament to this is the differences of opinions amongst these philosophers themselves. It's true that Aristotle believed in God. He was apparently a monotheist. Same thing goes with Plato. But how many differences of opinions did they have amongst themselves? For example, Plato believed in the eternity of the human spirit. He believed that the human spirit existed before the body was created. Aristotle believed that no, the human spirit is generated with the generation and creation of the body. This is a difference of opinion here between these two, and only one of them can be correct. Obviously, why? Because they contradict one another, right? So we can't say that from all points of view, right, all of these philosophers arrived at the same conclusions that the divine revelations speak about. They believed in the same thing that the divine revelations speak about. Yes, in certain general matters, right, they arrived at certain correct conclusions, right, on their own without the assistance of divine revelation. But that amount is not sufficient for the procurement of that felicity and happiness that is necessary for the human being. So there is still a need for the assistance of divine revelation. Thank you for joining us here. Today we were speaking about the necessity of the divine revelation and prophethood. Until next time, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Shiraz Hussein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy on the program The Key on IRIB English Radio.
You can also send your questions to English Radio at irib.ir.
In the limelight.
It's no accident that the United States of America experienced more COVID-19 deaths in 2020 than any other country, and one of the world's highest per capita death rates. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Stephen H. Wolf, author. This article is published under the heading, COVID-19 Pandemic May Be Winding Down, But Americans Are Still Sick and Dying. Stay tuned for more. It's no accident that the United States of America experienced more COVID-19 deaths in 2020 than any other country and one of the world's highest per capita death rates. We can and should blame the nation's bungled response, but a U.S. health disadvantage predates and extends far beyond COVID-19. Unless we understand and address the root causes of what's ailing Americans, the American people will continue to experience greater illness and early death for years to come. In 2013, Americans led a cross-national study for the National Research Council and Institute of Medicine. The report, U.S. Health in International Perspective, Shorter Lives, Poorer Health, documented how Americans, even the most advantaged ones, are less healthy and dying earlier compared to people in other rich nations. Evidence of a large and growing U.S. health disadvantage extends back to the 1980s and persists to this day. U.S. life expectancy dropped below the OECD average in 1998 and has since fallen further behind. By 2010, the life expectancy of Americans stopped improving altogether, plateauing until 2014 and then decreasing for three consecutive years. While it continued to climb in peer nations, by 2018, the U.S. ranked 46th in life expectancy worldwide, according to the World Bank. With the arrival of COVID-19 in late 2019, its global spread in 2020 and its devastating effects on human mortality, life expectancy was bound to fall in many nations. But the extent of the decline in the U.S. has been shocking. A recently published study co-authored with Ryan Masters shows that in 2020, U.S. life expectancy plunged 1.9 years, a drop not seen since the Second World War. This decline was 8.5 times greater than the average experienced by 16 other high-income nations, further widening cross-national life expectancy gap. In American communities of color, the drop was even more alarming. Compared to a decrease of 1.4 years among white Americans, life expectancy among black and Hispanic Americans fell 3.3 years and 3.9 years, respectively. Years of progress in narrowing black-white mortality gap were erased, and the Hispanic population, which has historically enjoyed longer life expectancy than whites, saw that advantage almost entirely erased. Unfortunately, data limitations prevented scientists from estimating changes for other important groups, including Native Americans, whose health and survival rates are among the worst in the nation. So how can this country prevent these excess deaths? Certainly not by spending more on healthcare, given that Americans already outspend every other country and still die prematurely. Healthcare, while essential, accounts for no more than 20% of health outcomes. The solutions extend beyond medicine. Epidemiologists, public health experts, and social scientists have long understood that their living conditions, the so-called social detriment of health, determine whether they live long, healthy, productive lives. The risk for disease and injury are strongly influenced by education, income, housing, neighborhoods, and workplaces, of course. Look living conditions that preserve health and promote well-being are simply lacking for too many Americans. Against a backdrop of growing income and wealth inequality, many families go without essential resources and basic protections, including education and training, good jobs, steady income, safe and affordable housing, and community services to help families raise children and support youth, older adults, and people with disabilities. A new National Academy's report found that death rates are increasing among Americans in the prime of life. At ages 25 to 64, when many are working, raising children, and caring for dependents. This means that, in addition to the many other challenges they face, American children and youth are now more likely to lose a parent and need bereavement care. The implications of these trends for families, communities, employers, and nation's economy and national security are enormous, but the solutions are no mystery. Curbing the decline in health of Americans requires adequate and equitable investments in children, education, jobs that pay a living wage, and affordable housing. Health depends on conditions outside the door, such as clean air, green space, strong social networks, and services for individuals and families with social, economic, and health needs. What distinguishes other countries with better health outcomes are sensible and equitable investments in people and places. And racial inequities have haunted this nation for generations. Let's be clear, it's racism, not race, that drives racial health disparities such as higher death rates from COVID-19 and dozens of other diseases. The steep declines in the survival of black and brown Americans that study reports are not explained by skin color, but instead reflect the systematic racism that permeates almost every aspect of life in this country, including health. People discomfited by the notion of systematic racism often blame its victims for lacking personal responsibility, but racial disparities are less about the choices people make than the choices society gives them. The end of the pandemic will bring relief to many Americans, but it will not end America's health and survival crisis. The good news is that solving the U.S. health disadvantage does not require a new slate of policy proposals, but a greater focus on those currently under debate. Policies to create jobs, expand infrastructure, invest in human capital, and address systematic racism will do more to address the U.S. health disadvantage than anything doctors or hospitals might do. The reverse is also true. Failure to act, not building an economy for the 21st century centered on people and justice, will condemn American children to shorter lives and poorer health, and diminish the future of the entire country. This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz for Indian subcontinent. And FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Badr 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.